Radio City with John Grayson and Rob Ross, and I'm Rob Ross here with, of course, my dear friend and cohort, John Grayson. John, first of all, how are you doing and how has your week been?
Not bad so far. In fact, yeah, we had a great weekend and we're looking forward to some interesting things going on over these next couple of days. But we'll get into the weekend in just a little while because it actually deals with one of the bands we'll be talking about. Something that was new to me, even though apparently these guys have been around for a very long time doing some interesting stuff on stages across the country. So more on that in just a while.
I think I know what you're talking about. And yes, indeed, we will have a lot of fun talking about it. But even though we're starting on sort of a light and brighter note, there is some sad and upsetting news to share with everyone. And hopefully things will have turned a corner by the time we get to the next show. But it seems that Aretha Franklin is in the hospital and it's reported that she's in, quote, very grave condition.
Yeah.
Now, the details of her illness has not been disclosed, but family and friends have been at her side. And her spokespeople have been asking for prayers and good thoughts. All I can do is hope for the best. She has had many, many serious health problems over the last few years. And all we can do is hope for the best for the Queen of Soul to rebound quickly.
Yeah. No doubt about it, because you look at everything that she's meant, not only to music, but I mean to one of the most iconic musical films of the last 50 years, that of course being the Blues Brothers. I mean, her voice and her presence in that film made it even more special than what they had already put in, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the one great thing about that movie, which at points is kind of spotty script-wise. The great thing about that movie is it's the one place you'll find X amount of legends. Aretha Franklin, James Brown, Ray Charles, the guys from Stax, you know,
right.
Half of Booker T and the MGs, Cropper and Dunn, you know, and so Matt Guitar Murphy and so on and so forth. So, you know, it's a wonderful, wonderful film just from a musically historic point of view.
And the way that she delivers that line, they look like Hasidic diamond merchants. I mean, that's just pure gold.
Drop dead brilliant. Who knew that she had a natural acting ability? But let's talk about, since we're on music, let's talk about music, because recently you've rethrown your hat into the fray of being a performing guitarist again.
And, yeah.
You told me quickly and in passing, and then I figured this was the best place for us to get into it, that things had changed a bit. So why don't you talk about your band and the situation that you are now in?
Yeah, it was about 4 months worth of work. And I mean, I know that doesn't sound like very much, and it really, in terms of being a band, isn't very much. But even after that short period of time, I saw some things going on that as a 20-year-old, I might have been willing to just let slide. But as a 48-year-old, I just honestly don't have time for, and I walked away. And it wasn't an easy thing to do. It's never an easy thing to do, especially when you've put in a lot of work and a lot of rehearsal time. And frankly, learned a lot of songs that even though I was acquainted with all of them, I knew them all, but I had never really spent any time sitting down and parsing them and learning my pieces and trying to figure out how, in what really amounted to a three-piece plus a singer, to put all of these things together, because some of them were bands that were five and six guys deep. And as a lead guitar player, it's not an easy thing to do. These were talented people that I was working with, and unfortunately, two of them had known each other for 50 years. And they were the two in the band that were my elders. And because they had that relationship, there was nothing that they felt uncomfortable with each other hiding. And what, unfortunately, that led to was a situation where in a 4-hour practice, there were times when we were spending, myself and the singer, were spending 2 hours or 2.5 hours of those 4 hours listening to them yell at each other. And I, like I said, I just don't have time for that. I mean, we ended up with a sound that was better, much better, I think, than adequate. And I'm not trying to brag here, but I think we were getting there and we were sounding good. And like I said, when I was 20 or 21 or 22 years old, that would have been plenty. And I would have, you know, dealt with whatever it took to be able to do that. But at 48 years old, there is nothing in me that wanted to go out and be a star. What I wanted to do was go out and have a good time on a stage with a bunch of people that I had some like and some respect for, and play some songs that were going to make people move around and buy more beer and all of the things that goes, you know, that go along with that kind of vibe. And I just felt like it was getting too much in the way. And there were some control issues along the way as well. The singer and I, it was, I'm sure you've dealt with this in the past as well, where you get a kiss and then a slap. So it's that idea of, well, we want you to bring more songs in. We want you to bring more ideas for songs in. And every time one of us did, what we were met with was, oh, that's interesting. And then it would just never happen. For some reason, our songs would get dropped from the list. It wasn't good enough, or somebody had a part they didn't feel comfortable playing. There was always a reason. There was always an excuse why it wasn't right and why it wasn't going to happen. And there was a desire on the part of one of the members of the band to find a set list full of songs that would spotlight him. And I don't need a spotlight on me. I'm fine. I'll get in. I'll play my parts. I'll see if I can make some people happy, but I don't need adulation. You know, I don't need people sitting out there going, wow, that's amazing, man. So I think if you still need that and you're in your 60s, it's indicative of the fact that you're not going to ever change that. And I hate to keep going back to saying I didn't have time for that. I just didn't have time for it. So rather than drag it out for another 4 months that I thought was going to be relatively fruitless, I decided to hang it up and walk away and look for something else to do.
You know, I wish I had that kind of foresight, especially when what I totally understand what you went through. Comparing and contrasting notes with my experiences, certainly with the Punchline, because that was the band that I was in the longest, even though it was over varying decades, really. The thing that I found most aggravating was I went through a lot of that, but it was, and this is not said in a meant in a way of self-pity, but, you know, as the leader of the band, and it was by default, you know, when you're writing the predominant amount of songs,
yeah,
you're the lead singer. We didn't have a lead guitarist per se. We had two guitars that played off of one another.
Yep.
But when you're putting in the work to try and book gigs, get photo shoots together, you know, managing the band, doing all the legwork, and you're met with indifference, the frustration mounts, tenfold, really.
Right.
And then you get to that point where you finally say your piece because you don't want to go and argue every time. And yet you seem to always be met with derision. Now, you know, you say to them, I think we should do this. Well, look, really, it shouldn't be a case of presenting it when you're stuck in that position.
Right.
Of having to lead. It's like, look, we're going to do this. That was my mistake. You know, you're in a four-piece band, and three of the members aren't pulling equal weight. You know, that's a headache. So it becomes a scene in the end where it's like, I'm not going to sit there sucking my thumb saying, please, fellas, can we get a band together again? You know, it's a case of, you know what, I don't need this.
Yeah.
You know, and I admit, my faults are many and plentiful, especially in my tenure with the Punchline. And if we were to ever reunite, it would simply be with under the guise of doing it for a hopefully a charity show, an animal based charity show. You know, yep. I would like to do something that would raise money for animals, and as a celebratory thing of the fact that we could possibly come together and make music again. That's it. I have no desire to be in a band, quote, full time. You know, and say, oh, I'm in a band. You know, I love the way that so many of the bands that I loved will get together on occasion, and they do it with joy, and they're not in each other's faces and each other's pockets and, you know, in each other's quarters. You know, I love it whenever I see the bongos because it's just joyful.
Yeah.
You know, the DBs, it's just joyful. And I don't have to worry about being some kind of, As our drummer had put it when we had gotten back together for round number 3 in 2004, he'd said, well, I want us to finally take our rightful place on the mantle of rock history. I think he was being facetious. I hope he was. Because like you, I don't need adulation. I don't like being the center of attention. I'm good at being a front man. I know this.
Yeah.
Because you have to be. Otherwise, you're going to get up there and not project, and you want to keep the audience entertained. That's what they're there to see.
Yeah. Well, not to interrupt, but to sort of add into that, there was an experience that I had about 5 months ago, and we've talked before about Pete Evick. Pete Evick is the lead guitar player for the Bret Michaels band, and not for Poison. He was not involved in that, but he, you know, always liked Bret, and the two of them got along, and they just, you know, they decided to put together what had been his solo group, Evick, as the backing band for Bret Michaels when he goes out and tours. And Pete is a wonderful guy. He also, by the way, runs a candle company, oddly enough, called Shining Soul, which is really cool. But that's kind of his day job. And about 5 months ago, I got a text from him that he was coming to town to play a show with Bret, and that Evick, his solo project, was going to play the night before in a little bar in High Ridge, Missouri, and did I want to come and see him? And so I said, of course, are you kidding? And went and saw the show, and it was great, and it was great fun. And at the end of the night, Pete said, why don't you come up and we'll play Bandidos? Which, because he's a big Refreshments fan, I'm a big Refreshments fan. So I said, sure, you know, and we just sat there, and no prep, you know, no rehearsal, no nothing. I didn't even know he was going to ask. And we got up there and banged out Bandidos and did the harmonies and everything else. And we had people in the audience who were dancing around and singing the song along with us, which surprised me a little because it's not that well known. And it was brilliant. And for those 5 minutes that we were on stage together, that's what I want to capture for 3 hours, or 4 hours during a gig. And if it can't be that, why? Why would I do it?
Right. Right. I mean, there. I know on many occasions, even on the show, I've bemoaned my years with the Punchline, but moments like that have happened, and they're gold. Our first show back together in 1991, where we were actually headlining, and it was at a local club, which I just remember. First of all, it was Halloween, and I do remember it as being incredibly hot and packed. So you had the physical energy of the room, and we did not expect an encore. You know, and we kept getting called out for encores, and then we were like, well, now what do? We didn't prepare for this. And I believe it was our bass player, Carl, who had the brilliant idea of doing Tomorrow Never Knows, except he didn't want to sing it, even though in the Punchline it was always, if we covered a Beatles song, he would do Lennon and I would naturally do McCartney.
Yeah.
But he didn't want to sing it. So I thought to myself, okay, well, you know, aren't you, you know, I'll do it. You know, it was like, why is it these guys never man up? But the thing is, we did it in a way that it sounded like us, but you knew what it was.
Yeah.
You know, I was using a Rickenbacker, and I was using a lot of feedback to get as many weird effects as I could. And then, you know, the part when he starts to sing through the foghorn.
Yeah.
Right. I just held the guitar up to my mouth and started singing into the pickups so you could get the foghorn effect coming through the F holes of the guitar.
What a great idea.
We just kept feeding back. And, you know, it just, whoever was doing the lights was brilliant because he started flashing them to make it really dramatic at the end, which worked. And the place went bonkers.
Yeah.
I loved that, you know, and I think kind of at the end, we like just collapsed on stage and it looked like a dramatic effect, but we were just wiped out.
You know? Yeah, it's like we do not have any more.
One by one, you know, we're all going down. I think Mark, the guitar player and Carl's brother, did it intentionally.
Yeah.
And Carl did it, and I was just like, oh, I'm tired. And then by the end, you know, Chris is still playing the boom, boom, bop, bop, boom, boom, boom. And then he just slumps over the drums, and it was magnificent.
Yeah.
But moments like that, you know, they're, I hate to say it, they're, you know, few and far between. But when you get them, even in a rehearsal, when you know the rehearsal is so good and you just look at one another and you don't have to say anything, you just kind of get that wide-eyed grin.
Yeah.
You know, it's a joyful thing. So, listen, you'll find something very quickly. You'll have a blast, and it'll be good. You know, you got your feet wet again.
Right.
That's all.
And that, you know, of that's exactly the conversation I had with my dad this week, is that I told him, I said, you know, I needed to know that I can still do this, and hold my own with other talented people. And I did. So, okay, that chapter is over, and now it's on to the next chapter. And however long it takes to wait to get there, I'm fine with that.
I mean, if you were in New York, this wouldn't even be a discussion.
Right. Yes, indeed. So, yeah, thank you for asking. But, yeah, everything is cool, and I walked away still able to look everybody in the eye. And the good thing is, and I, you know, again, not to pat myself on the back, but I tried to be as mature as possible. And the first person that I contacted was the singer and said, look, these are the problems that I'm having. What do you think? And her response was, oh, you too, huh? So it wasn't, I didn't want to leave her high and dry in all of this and just walk away. But, yeah. You know, and I think she appreciated that. And I hope anyway that was the right way to go about it.
I would say it was, but having experienced it, you know, sure, I'm prone to agree.
Yeah. So, yeah, on we go, and we've got a whole bunch more going on this week as you, well, boy, there are a thousand different places we can start. So let's start with some more fun stuff in the musical realm, because there's something that has just resurfaced that nobody has heard in 40 years since it was originally laid down. And the names that are involved in this can't help but excite a lot of feelings in you, I know, in me, definitely. And I mean, for anybody who has ever heard, oh, the DBs or Chris Bell or Alex Chilton or, you know, anything that's remotely involved in any of that, this is fantastic.
It is. It is called The Death of Rock. It is coming out on Omnivore Recordings. Once again, the good folks at Omnivore just continue to shine. And God, I love those people.
Yep.
Just no end of respect for them, because and I'll get to the story behind this. And it's called Alex Chilton versus Peter Holzapfel.
Again, I love the way it's framed.
The short story goes like this, and just the story alone is worth the price of admission. Peter Holzapfel had just come to Memphis as his, you know, childhood friend and former bandmate Chris Stamey had already played with Alex Chilton up in New York.
Yep.
Peter Holzapfel had moved to Memphis with the idea that he was going to get Chris Bell to produce his music. Bell basically blew him off. But somehow Peter was put in touch with the also late Richard Roseborough, who was an in-house engineer at Ardent, producer, drummer, musician, all-around nice guy, friend to everybody in the scene. The two of them connected really well and began recording at Philips Recording Service. Okay? And Alex Chilton happened to be there. I should say this was in 1978. Alex Chilton happened to be there at the same time recording what became Like Flies on Sherbert, his debut solo album, which is considered now one of the first linchpins of what is now known as the lo-fi sound. The quote goes something like, yeah, I heard some of what you were doing, and I think it sucks. So here, let me show you how it's done.
Ooh. Uh-huh.
And this is what I love so much about Peter Holzapfel and respect about him so much. He's so diplomatic in the telling of the story that's been printed. And he said, you know, I could see where Alex was coming from because he didn't want any of that fan worship adulation thing. Now, I think that's an incredibly astute and kind thing for him to say.
Sure.
I say it's a real dick thing for Alex to have said. Who wouldn't think that? That's just, but that was Alex Chilton for you. You know, love him or hate him, good, bad, or indifferent, he was consistent.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that scene in Nothing Can Hurt Me where he's backstage at the Big Star Reunion show in 93 and somebody says, will you sign this for me? And they hand him a copy of Radio City. And he goes, yeah, you keep buying them. I'll keep signing them. Like, charming, just charming. But anyway, so these tapes were discovered through the estate of the Roseborough family. And on this, and this is what I'm really dying to hear, Peter Holzapfel's original versions of all things, Bad Reputation, which wound up on Stands for Decibels, wow, the first DB's album. Girl, it's and We Were Happy There, which is one of my favorite songs off the second album, repercussion. And there are a whole bunch of things that Alex Chilton did, including a song that had kind of drifted out on bootlegs called Tennis Bum and a couple of rock and roll classic covers. And it just, it portends to be, if nothing else, a fun listen.
Yeah.
How can you not love the idea of this? Because really, how many times have I said in the years that you and I have known each other and have done the show that to me, the DBs are, in fact, the direct link and the immediate offshoot of Big Star.
Sure.
You've got the Chris Bell and Alex Chilton connection to Chris Stamey because Stamey put out I Am the Cosmos, and he worked with Chilton. You've got Holes Apple having worked with Chilton and Richard Roseborough, and by the way, Ken Woodley, who played bass with Peter Holes Apple and Richard Roseborough. That was the rhythm section that's on I Am the Cosmos. You know, I mean, it's just all tied together beautifully.
Yeah.
And it proves my theory once again that the DBs are indeed the heirs apparent to the Big Star throne.
Yeah, I'm with you. I cannot wait to just dive into this thing like few other things and just live with it for a long time. I mean, these recordings are
a couple of very short months, so be ready. In the meantime, next week we will talk about what I have in my hands, finally, because of some very, very poor screw-ups by the distribution company that handles the shipping for Omnivore, 11 Spot, who I've had problems with in the past. I finally received my pre-ordered copy, 3 weeks after release, of Peter Holes Apple's first solo album in 21 years, Game Day, which, according to the sticker, quote, "And it's really solo too," says Holes Apple. "I played and sang 99 and 44 100% of the notes on this record. I hope you like the results as much as I do." And he's advertised as Peter Holes Apple, parentheses, the DBs, Continental Drifters, REM, and Hootie adjunct.
Nice, nice. And, you know, it just goes to show, again, the great thing about that is obviously you'll be able to listen to the brand new stuff and listen to him 40 years ago alongside Alex Chilton and just, you know, spend some time in your head comparing, contrasting, and just enjoying.
Exactly, because, you know, the thing is, if you've listened to, like, Flies on Sherbert, your immediate response is, and this was mine when I heard it for the first time, I thought, this is shit.
Yeah.
This is just horrible because it sounds horrible. The timing is off. He's playing the drums. He's not a drummer. It's too goofy for its own good. It sounds like drunken mayhem, but there's a certain weird charm about it once you've lived with it and listened to it. You know, things like Rock Hard and Little Girl, Hey Little Girl, whatever it's called, you know, it's just a funny, weird record. See, I was primed for something on the order of Bangkok, which I thought was a fantastic and radically different thing for him to come right out of the box with as his first solo single after Big Star.
Yeah.
Because it's upbeat, it's poppy, it's weird, it's funny, it's very wry and dark. You know, it's a neat song, and I thought, oh man, if this album's anything like that single, and it's not. But I still maintain that out of all his solo records, I still like Flies on Sherbert most.
Excellent. So, again, all kinds of great news coming out surrounding Peter Holes Apple and some great music that's already out. So I'm looking forward to hearing what you think after you've gone through that new CD. And we'll get some more words on an upcoming edition of Radio City. Now I get to tell you a story. And I love this because you know that as much as that whole universe of Big Star and everything that surrounded them is fascinating to you. And it's fascinating to a lot of people who have been fans of all of these things. You find out where those connections are and you start following them. And it's just, it's a rabbit hole, but it's a fun rabbit hole to live in.
God, it is.
And my rabbit hole is the Wrecking Crew. And the more that I learn about them and the more that I have the opportunity to talk to the guys who are still around that were part of the Wrecking Crew and listen to their opinions about each other and the stories that they have, these incredible stories about the music, the more fun it becomes. And it's that same kind of rabbit hole. So this week, our conversation, which, by the way, is, again, cheap plug here up on KTRS.com, is with a member of the Wrecking Crew that is... I don't want to call him peripheral because he isn't. I mean, he was integral to what happened, but he's not one of those names that immediately trips off the tongue. Although, if you think of probably the most famous one is the Frank Sinatra song, That's Life. And that beautiful, thick organ sound that permeates that entire song. That was laid down. That was a track that was laid down and played live, by the way, alongside Frank Sinatra by this guy, Michel Rubini. And Michel Rubini was a member of the Wrecking Crew. He released a book earlier this year called Life in the Key of Rubini. Get the book because, it, first of all, it, among other things, he spent a lot of time with Sonny and Cher in the early days, played with Sinatra, dated Wonder Woman. I mean, this man met Linda Carter at a Sonny and Cher show, and the two of them were an item for a while. That in itself is enough for a book, I'm sure. But here's the magic. He told a story about Harry Nilsson, and I love that guy. I mean, of all of the people who were gone before I really appreciated what he did, he's the one that I kind of regret the most, and since then have made up for it in spades. And what happened was Rubini took a trip to Maui and just happened to run into Nilsson, who was there on a vacation of his own. They actually ran into each other at a convenience store on Maui. And, it just so happened that at the time Nilsson's wife was pregnant. So what he told Rubini was, "Hey, I've got some acid, but don't tell my wife we're tripping because she can't do anything. She's pregnant." So the two of them, and the wife, and the girl that, that Michelle was with, they all went down to this black sand beach on Maui and just hung out. And while they were there, Nilsson started telling Rubini about this idea he had in his head and some songs to go along with it for a story about a little boy who grew up in a town where everybody had pointy heads except him.
Oh, the Tale of Oblio.
Yes. And so that, so this guy ended up being the first one other than Nilsson himself to hear the story of the point. And it was all while they were sitting on a black sand beach on Maui, just off their asses on acid. So it's stories like that through the entire thing. And he was such an engaging character to talk to. And the book is fantastic. So if you're looking for a nice read for the remainder of what's left of the summer, you could do a lot worse than that one.
Wow, that does sound really good because, you know, Harry Nilsson in and of himself was a guy that was just, he was a story.
Oh, yeah.
He probably didn't have to do any music. That's how much of a story he was. I mean, I always loved the tales that Mickey Dolenz would tell about him and, you know, but it sounds like, it's funny, I know the name. I've seen it in passing.
You know? Oh, Rubini, yeah. And I'm sure he's credited on a bunch of stuff, but yeah, he was running down the list of songs that he played on, and my jaw kept getting farther and farther, you know, dropping. I was just amazed. And curiously enough, I was at my favorite guitar shop today, just congratulating the guys who were in the concert that we'll be talking about in just a little while, and ran into a guy who is with a St. Louis band called Pavlov's Dog. And Pavlov's Dog was a prog rock band back in the early 70s. And they sort of reformed in 1990. And this guy hangs out at Killer Vintage all the time. And I was telling him that story about Rubini and Harry Nilsson. And he told me one. And he said there was a time when Harry and John Lennon and, who else was it? Keith Moon were, the three of them drinking in New York City. And they went to see a show, and Moon decided that he needed to sit in with the band. So he went up on stage, and he started playing, and Harry started playing. And at one point during the show, from behind the drum kit, Moon stood up and dropped trow and waved his dick at the crowd. And then the rest of them followed suit, and they were all arrested and hauled off to jail. And the woman who was the lawyer for two of the three of them, for Lennon and Nilsson, got a call at 3:30 in the morning from the police who said, "Hey, you know, we've got these three guys and they're all locked up in our tank. And you're the lawyer for two of them. So we figured you were the most logical person to call." And she said into the phone, "Hang them," and hung up the phone. So, yeah, you know, but it's just that was rock and roll in 1976, you know?
And speaking of, you know, rock and roll, because what's wonderful is we're on a theme right now. I didn't get to attend last night, and part of me, you know, is eating his guts up over it, but because of my foot and not being able to walk and being uncomfortable and physically tired. Last night, I want to give a shout out, an applause, and love and congratulations to our friend Richard Barone.
Yes.
Putting on what was apparently the spectacular of the year at the Central Park Summer Stage. He did the Greenwich Village Songs of the 60s, bringing out as many performers from that era and from that actual scene as possible. We're talking from John Sebastian, God help me,
yeah,
to Jose Feliciano, to Maria Muldaur, to Jesse Colin Young, and so on down the list. And apparently it was just an absolute knockout of a show. And of course, I'm sitting home with my foot propped up and on ice. Oh. Still, you know, I'm nearly healed, but it's just, I can't go out. I can't do anything for too long, and I can't be on my feet. You know, certainly if I would have had to have stood at a concert, you know, no less at a packed concert in Central Park. So, but congratulations to Richard. I knew you would pull this off. You always do. And what can I say? You know, I love him, and I'm really happy and proud for him.
Yeah, that's excellent. Good news. And we've also got good news about more new music, because the Posies, there's a new offering from them as well. What's going on there?
Well, yet again, our friends at Omnivore Recordings,
of course,
doing what they started out doing initially by reissuing, have in fact reissued the first two Posies albums that had come out on DGC Records when they were touted as the next big thing. Dear 23 and Frosting on the Beater, 1991 and 1993, respectively. That's how I was first introduced to the band, with Dear 23, when I saw them before I even had the album, at Maxwell's in, I want to say it was early 91. And a friend of mine, a work colleague at my first job at Roadrunner Records, said, hey, I think you'll really like this band. They do those kind of harmonies that you're really into. Let's go see them there at Maxwell's. And I thought they were pretty good. You know, and of course, I was kind of nonplussed when they did King Midas in reverse, and there were only two harmonies, because having been in a band that covered it, and it had the three harmonies, you know, I was like, well, you know.
Yeah, right.
But I became a fan of the band right then and bought the two albums. And Omnivore has done, because this is, in fact, the 30th anniversary of the Posies, they've been doing a reissue campaign. They reissued the first Posies album, Failure, last year. That had originally come out on Pop Llama. This time they're doing the Geffen albums, and coming up in October will be the third of the series, Amazing Disgrace, which has one of my favorite songs by them, Everybody is a Fucking Mariah. Back off in disgust. Most honesty jeopardized trust. Is everybody such a fucking liar? Damsels in dismay. A man's mental in his own way. Year 23 and Frosting on the Beater sounds so good. They've been remastered and remixed, and they just explode out of the speakers. And one disc, one of the sets has no less than 27 bonus tracks, aside from the original album.
Wow.
The other has 30. On the first album, on Year 23, they've included the Pop Llama single from 1992, I Am the Cosmos, Feel. So, huge doff of the cap there.
Right.
You know? And this was, in fact, reviewed and posted by me for my first offering with MusicTap.net, which I'm writing for now as well. So you will see a lot more of my work on MusicTap. It's a very nice group of people that really know their music. This isn't some kind of self-aggrandizement, look at me, I'm cool. This is just writing about the music, telling a little story about how you know of this band.
Yeah.
Getting into it, which is how music writing should be. So I hope you'll look for it. I hope you'll read it. Most importantly, I hope you will go back and check out these two magnificent albums by the Posies. These are two essential albums. So,
excellent. And by the way, since I did not mention him by name, thank you so much to David Surkamp of Pavlov's Dog for that story about Keith Moon and John Lennon and Harry Nilsson. And by the way, if the name doesn't ring a bell with Pavlov's Dog, It was David Surkamp was lead vocals and backing guitars. The lead guitar player was a gentleman named Steve Scorfina, who was one of the original founding members of REO Speedwagon back in the late 1960s. So yeah, they definitely had some talent behind what they were doing. And it's, again, another great band to go back and check out if you missed them the first time around.
Now, being that I'm sensing that we're doing a feel-good show, yeah, which is nice, it's a real nice change of pace, I've got a story that I want to share because please, I'm very happy and proud of this. We're getting to the point of the end of the Little League World Series. And it just so happens that this year, one of the teams that is in the finals, going to Williamsport, Pennsylvania, for the absolute championship, is the Mid-Island League from Staten Island.
Oh, excellent.
They've almost gotten there before, but now they're going. And they got there this past Saturday. I'm sorry, it was yesterday because it was the game was rained out on Saturday. They got there with a perfect game.
Oh. They
threw a perfect game. I cannot be happier or prouder for these kids. Their coaches, just a fantastic job. And this is what I love so much about Staten Island. You know, there are a lot of differentiating factions here, a lot of very negative vibes, a lot of bad stereotypes and cliches, a lot of negative things that are written about us. But as a whole community, there cannot be one negative thing said, 150,000% shared positive joy that these kids are doing something really special. You know, if they win the World Series, fantastic. The fact that they got there, you can't help but be really proud and just absolutely overjoyed for them because they worked their butts off and they did it. And a perfect game, to me, you already won.
Yeah, right, exactly. And boy, to get there with a no-no, like you said, that's just incredible. Can you imagine what that pitcher was feeling after that game?
Oh, it was just, I saw some of the highlights because I missed the actual game, which was in fact broadcast on ESPN.
Yeah.
But to see the way, I mean, masterful pitching, but incredibly great feeling. You know, these kids were playing with the fundies that the Mets can't play with.
Right.
You know, your basics. I mean, I saw a play at first base that, you know, that kid, and he wasn't a big kid either, you know. He was fairly short in stature. He stretched, rolled over, and tagged the base before the runner got there. I mean, that's thinking.
Yeah.
That's playing baseball the right way.
Right, with your head.
So, and these kids are playing with a hell of a lot of heart, too. So,
good deal.
Congratulations, Mid-Island League. I'm certainly very proud of you as a fellow Islander. God bless.
Definitely. And before we leave sports, a couple of things. First of all, a sad goodbye this week to a guy who was hockey for a lot of people. And especially, you know, even though where I am, obviously, there's a lot of Blues fans, and the rivalry between the Blues and the Hawks and the Blues and the Wings, you know, those are things that run very, very deep. And yet, to see from people that I know were diehard Blues fans all of the outpouring about the death of Stan Mikita this week, it was really kind of cool to watch that happen and to say, you know what, that guy, no matter what sweater he was wearing at the time, that guy deserves everybody's attention.
You know, I never got to see him play, but everything I know about him was just, he was one of those that, he was Mr. Hockey, just like Gordie Howe was.
Yeah, right.
It's that simple. I mean, he, you know, of course he was cemented into legend thanks to something as lame-brained as Wayne's World, but still, you know, he's one of that echelon, you know, Gordie Howe, Stan Mikita, Bobby Hull, Harry Howell, you know, those guys who really made Toe Blake.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you don't say Toe Blake and Eddie Shore, there's a problem.
Piss on Eddie Shore.
That's right. Piss on old-time hockey. Oh, but yeah, it definitely is a sad goodbye and a fond farewell to Stan Mikita, because he did. He means so much to the history of the game. So doff of the cap to him as well. And we've got a few more things to go over. As you said, the Mid-Island League, congratulations once again to them. But there was another story to tell. And we'll get to some of the politics as well. But had the opportunity to see a band this week. Because the guys that, two of them anyway, or three of them actually, who work at my favorite guitar shop, have a tribute band. And to call them a tribute band is really selling it short. But they do these shows once every summer at the big outdoor amphitheater in town, and they sell it out. And then they do a week's worth of shows at the Pageant, which is about a 1,500-seat theater in the University City area of St. Louis, and they sell it out for a week doing these Pink Floyd shows. And it's, you know, my wife and I, a few years back, went to see Aussie Floyd, the Australian Pink Floyd band that has David Gilmour's, you know, seal of approval and all of that. And they were great. And that was a fun show. Jen had never seen El Monstero before this Saturday, this past Saturday. I'd seen him a bunch of times, but she just hadn't gone with me. She went with me this time, and halfway through the show, she leaned over and said, you know, those Australian guys should see this. They could take a couple of notes. And I thought, yeah, you know what? You're right, because it's so much fun. And the thing is, they have a blast with it. Not only are they great players, but they build a show. I mean, they have a lot of, like the pig guards from The Wall, the movie, they have guys come out dressed up like that, you know, flashing the flashlights into the audience and the whole thing. And it's just a good time. So I knew what I was in for there. What I didn't know is that they had an opening act. When I found out that the opening act was this group called The Mummies, of whom I had never heard, I thought, okay, well, this will be interesting. And then they came out and blew the place away. You knew of them because I said, you know, I sent you a couple of links this week and you went, oh, I love these guys. I had never seen them before and I can't wait to see them again. The whole show band thing is a very tricky thing to do. And it's a tricky thing to do because you can easily slide into maudlin and you can easily slide into, you know, just overdoing it and becoming a sort of a parody of yourself. But these guys can come out dressed like mummies, and they've got guys in the Egyptian, you know, dog, you know, head helmets and things like that. And they play this mix of, there's a Latin groove underneath a lot of it. There's a lot of soul. There's a lot of funk. And they just have a blast. And they're all killer players, but they play it up exactly the right amount so that it doesn't get, oh, yeah, I see what you're doing. It's just fun. And everybody had a blast, and everybody loved it.
It's moving out restriction with purpose and conviction. We'll work like a well-oiled machine.
I saw the Mummies back in the 90s. It was hysterical. They played with Man or Astro Man.
Oh, pretty nice.
Blast of a band. If I'm not mistaken, they're playing together again soon. But I saw them, and they were just, it was like watching the best, most out-of-control garage rock band.
Yeah.
You know, garage of the 60s with the Farfisa sound going absolutely bonkers. And, yep, they had the whole thing on, and the keyboard player would just shove the organ all over the stage, and they push each other and yell at each other. I mean, it's hilarious. You're watching these four mummies screaming at each other, but they didn't, you know, they yell at each other and then they pick up right in the middle of the song. You
right.
know, they had the shtick down so to a T, and they've been around now almost 30 years at the very least. They're so popular that Pete Buck had put out the single, You Must Fight to Live on the Planet of the Apes. That's a Mummies track.
Right.
You know, they're so much fun. I will send you one of my favorite video clips of theirs, and you'll be on the floor in hysterics because it's just cheaply filmed, but there they are just going nuts on stage, and it's hysterical. I'm so glad you got to see them because they are a blast and a half.
Yeah, and that's, like I said, that I had a friend when I was in high school, one of the most talented guitar players I've ever met, and he's one of those people that I look at and go, you know what? That's why I didn't decide to go down that road into a career or to attempt a career in music. Because if Scott Sutter couldn't be a star, and he never was, then what hope do the rest of us have for any kind of fairness in that realm at all? And so he was in a band that was called the Animal Spirits Show Band. And they toured and they did the whole bit, and they had a Blues Brothers part of the show, and they had a lounge act part of the show and all of this. And it was a great time, but it wasn't anywhere near the level of what we saw on Saturday night. And so I mean, are there more of those show bands that are out there that everybody should know about? And yet, you know, my comment to you was, I don't know that I would ever go out and buy a Mummies CD, but if I heard they were coming anywhere within 100 miles of here, I would buy tickets today.
Here's the thing about buying records now and seeing a band of that ilk, you know, you're going to enjoy the show more than the records.
Right.
More often than not. I mean, it's just a fact.
And they're good songs. I'm not taking anything away, you know, from the songs. There was a song called Friction that I thought was a very well-conceived piece.
Well, I'll tell you what. If they play New York, I'm going to go see them again because you've inspired me. Because, like I said, since the mid-90s.
Yeah.
You know, they were all, it's ironic, they were all part of that Munster from Spain, Munster Records.
Right.
They, Manor Astro, and a whole bunch of those kinds of bands, you know. We had a lot of bands of that ilk, not show bands in the way that the Mummies really execute. But we had things like the Colored Greens, because they're, you know, two black twins, you know, playing punk rock kind of thing, you know, and the urban outdoorsmen, and, you know, who else was there? The Astro Zombies, you know, it was kind of that. It was an attempt at reviving garage rock.
They're
sort of like the bastard sons and daughters of Nuggets,
right?
If you will. So,
yeah, and I mean, you could make the case, and I think that Mother's Ball would probably go right down that road with you. That Devo was that same kind of thing. That the concept behind Devo, and he said a bunch of times, I never conceived a band. I conceived a performance art piece. So, you know, it's kind of those same tentacles.
Well, here's the funny thing, you know. Devo was performance art that turned into a band.
Yeah.
And performance art just sucks.
Right.
So,
and bands are great.
Right. Because performance art means you have no discernible talent.
Right.
You know, and I don't count Laurie Anderson in that because I don't think she's performance art. I think she's art. There is a very clear distinction. Andy Kaufman was performance art without knowing it.
Yes.
Because he was so far ahead of the curve that I hate performance art. It just smacks of preciousness and pretension.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very David Byrne kind of thing, and I don't abide. So.
And on that subject, that gives us the opportunity to get into a very small smattering of politics for this week as well, because this performance art bullcrap that's going on in the White House right now under the guise, and out of the White House, under the guise of any kind of governance whatsoever, with Omarosa, friggin' Megan, whatever the hell her name is,
That's an Italian dish.
What kills me about this, again, is that people are going down such an obvious path with this. And you have, when she was on TV during the campaign and said, everybody, all of Donald Trump's detractors will bow down before him. And the liberals lost their friggin' minds and started going, oh, how could she say that? Who is this woman? She's nothing. And now that she's tearing down Donald Trump, they're going, oh, wow, you know, she really knows her stuff. No, well, she doesn't.
Yeah, obviously liberals know exactly what they're talking about. Don't forget the whole, you know, Comey cost Hillary the election. Oh, Comey's a good man.
Yeah.
No, he's not.
Right,
you know,
right.
Stop.
Right. She's crap,
you know,
and she was always crap.
Such a feel-good vibe. I'm not going to let politics get in the way. I'm just going to throw a few things out, and we can just, you know, check them off the list because they happen, and that's that. One, Peter Strzok was fired today.
Yep.
The FBI. And that's not bigger news than I'm surprised that it's kind of being kept low-key. Number two, all of the special elections that were held last week, the election in Ohio, the Republicans still won by a margin of, what, 2,000 votes?
Something like that, yeah. Kansas, same thing.
Yeah, end of story. There was nothing happening in New York, so it really doesn't matter. So there you go. But, of course, what's everybody going on and on about this week in loony liberal land? It seems the only two viable candidates for 2020 are Biden or Sanders. No, and are you fucking kidding me?
Right.
Stop right there. I'm telling you right now, John, you and I will – I'm not even going to be nice about it. The day after Election Day, I'm going to pop a bottle of champagne and say, see, you didn't focus on 2018.
Right.
Told you so.
Right.
And then I'm going to drop trowel and I'm going to wag my dick at every one of these assholes.
See, now we're back to Slapshot. I'm going to flash him, Joe. I'm going to go. I'm going to walk down that aisle. I'm going to open this stupid faggot bathrobe and wiggle my dick at him.
I hope you die of a heart attack.
Yeah.
Fill in any name you want.
Oh, fantastic. But yeah, that, I mean, that is exactly right, because it's a bad parody of itself, and it's getting no better, and it's getting no closer to any kind of discernible denouement. There's just, it's sad, and there's nobody that has the reins. It's everything we've already said. So like you said, let's just move on from it and go.
Exactly. Let them cut their own collective throats. Because you know what? It's not going to change our lives. As you've said many, many times, quite wisely and quite rationally, which nobody seems to have an inkling towards the notion of, we're still going to be here tomorrow.
Yeah.
You know, we've lived through Johnson, Nixon, Ford. I mean, if we could live through Ford and Carter.
Yeah, and Carter, you know, right.
Reagan, Bush, Clinton, Bush, Obama, and now Trump. Big fucking deal.
Yeah, the system was built to survive this. It will survive this.
Right. 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 If people really cared enough, they would keep their mouths shut, go out and vote. But everybody loves the histrionics.
Right. Yeah, and this sideshow, this, you know, over the course of this weekend, it means absolutely nothing to me. Somebody posted the only chuckle that I got over any of this was the fact that somebody posted something on Facebook that said, you know, right now the White House is tripping over itself, over Omarosa, to say that a reality show has no place in the White House. And you know what? They're right.
So now we've come to that glorious moment of the episode this week called In Our Heads.
Yes. And In Our Heads this week, and what I want to go back to is what we started the show with, unfortunately, is that news that right now everybody is busy with the outpouring of support for Aretha Franklin, and rightly so, because she is such a force in music. And it's funny that she's, again, one of those people who has the honor of being name-checked before name-checking became a thing that everybody did. You know, you had Aretha Franklin, who was name-checked by, of all people, Steely Dan, and, you know, the Hey 19 thing. And it was done in a kind of a tongue-in-cheek way, but not toward her. I mean, it was obviously honoring her, but just tongue-in-cheek to the character that that song was written about.
Hey 19, that's Aretha Franklin. She don't remember Queen of Soul. Hard times befallin' soul survivors. She thinks I'm crazy, but I'm just growing old. Hey 19.
It's one of my favorite things to see who it is and where these names pop up in popular music, and whether it's another musician or whether it's somebody that they just write about. Like, even though I'm not a huge fan of the song, I like the idea of the Moody Blues' Timothy Leary. It's just, it's one of those things. Somebody needed to write a song about that guy that was really obviously about that guy because it name checked him. And I wonder, in that same vein of those times where even the DBs being name checked by They Might Be Giants is something that I really think is kind of cool.
Children by the Millions, wait for Alex Chilton.
Yeah.
When he comes around.
Yeah.
The replacement.
Right.
Like shooting fish in a barrel, son. Well, you know, I may have mentioned it on one of the previous shows, but as it turns out, Paul Westerberg really isn't that devoted to Alex Chilton per se. I mean, he was definitely a fan of Big Star by his, you know, but he didn't love Alex Chilton. I have a feeling it was the personality thing.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's funny because not all of the times when somebody writes a song about somebody else and names them in the song, it's not always a loving tribute. Sometimes there are those people that tear down somebody else.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, here's the funny thing. You know, you've got a song like, and you just mentioned They Might Be Giants. Hi, We're the Replacements.
Yep.
You know, which is really funny.
Right.
There's, and here we go. The trifecta. The Replacements had a song called Something to Do, and that was D-U with the umlauts over it.
Right.
It was their little thumb jab at the Hooskers. You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And of course, there's things like songs. I think it was called political song for Michael Jackson to sing,
mm-hmm,
by the Minutemen.
Right.
And then there was another one. I can't remember the exact title. It's by Firehose, who of course were the offshoot of the Minutemen after the death of Dee Boone, called "Song for the Singer of R.E.M."
Oh, nice. Okay.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of. And you want the ultimate name check was in the lyrics to History Lesson Part 2 by the Minutemen.
Our band of scientists rock. But I was E. Bloom and Richard Hell, Joe Strummer, and John Doe. Me and Mike Watt playing a guitar.
And it was E. Bloom being Eric Bloom from Blue Oyster Cult.
Right.
And so in one fell swoop, they listed their heroes. You know, those are the ones that I tend to think about, and you know, there is one, and I'm going to throw this out there because it's a song that has never been released, but it may be on the next co-op communique. It was a song that I did with a band called Smile,
mm-hmm,
and I wrote the song with our bass player, Michael, who was one of the funniest, most clever, a master wordsmith, just in conversation. He could turn a phrase like nobody's business, one of my favorite people in the world to this day. And we were bored waiting for the other guys in the band to show up for a rehearsal. This was 1993. And we were watching a Mets-Marlins game. And we wrote a song together called Robin Hitchcock's Clothes. It was just filled with in-jokes, but in a very clever – and I still have the lyric sheet. You can tell who wrote what line, mm-hmm, by the handwriting.
Yeah.
And we did this middle eighth bridge that was hysterical. You know, we make a lot of in-jokes from Robin Hitchcock lyrics too.
Yeah.
But I wish I could – and the line goes, I wish I could groove just like a Juve. And I polished it off with, I wish I'd listened to the move. You know? And I wasn't doing drugs at that time, so I don't know where that came from. But, you know, see, all I can tell you is, you know.
See, to me, the reason for those kinds of name checks obviously is part of a tribute by the artist himself. But the usefulness for it, and I've got three that I'm going to throw at you. And these are not going to be things, except for one of them, maybe that you're going to think of as my thing, generally speaking. But I found that there are times when I'll hear a name in a song and I'll hear, you know, an artist refer to somebody and I'll think, okay, that's obviously somebody that meant something to this guy. So even though I don't know who that is, maybe I should go investigate. And the first time it happened, I was about 8 years old. And I've mentioned before, my dad still is a huge Jimmy Buffett fan. Loved that stuff. Everything up to about Coconut Telegraph. And then he just kind of, you know, left it go, because after that, it just kind of started repeating itself anyway. But there's a song that Buffett did, and I want to say it was on maybe Changes in Latitudes, a song called The Wino and I Know.
Ice Cream Man, he's a hillbilly fan. Got 78s by Hank Snow. Walks down the street, shuffling his feet to a rhythm that only he knows. And I've seen him in so many places. I saw him the night I was born in a Bourbon Street bar. I received my first scar from an old man so tattered and torn.
And I heard that name and went, okay, who the hell is Hank Snow? So I went to the record store and found out who Hank Snow was, and I've never been happier. The other one was when in Washington Bullets, the Clash name-checked Victor Jara, who was, of course, killed off in Santiago Stadium by Augusto Pinochet, Augusto Pinochet's forces and the CIA and all of that, and he was a folk singer. And they broke his hands because he was singing anti-government songs and pro-Allende songs, and so they murdered him. And I thought, okay, I got to find out more about this guy and what an incredible performer and player he was. So I got those two from them. And the third one is kind of the reverse of that, because a guy who has become a very good friend of mine over time and one of the true good guys of that sort of second-tier road dog touring band scene, and there's a bunch of them out there, and please go support them, a band called Sherman. And Aaron Beavers wrote a song called Country Just Ain't Country Anymore, and he name checks in that song. One of the lines in the song is, thank you Willie and Waylon, because you gave us something more. And obviously Willie Nelson and Waylon Jennings, very, very big fan of both of theirs, but to hear them come up and to hear that kind of love coming from somebody like Aaron was really cool. And so I hope that through saying this, folks who are listening to us have this conversation will be inspired to go check out Aaron Beavers and Sherman, because I think you're going to find a lot of stuff you like.
I got one more really obscure one for you. Nick Hayward.
Uh-huh.
You know, from Haircut 100.
Yep.
He had an album, a wonderful album on Epic back in 93 called From Monday to Sunday. And there's a song called Caravan. And you could tell this is totally from the heart. The line in the chorus repeated is, she just wants to hear the jam.
Yeah.
And in concert, and I had taken my cousin Michelle to go see Nick Hayward play in New York for the first time since the Haircut 100 days. And, you know, I had played her the album. I'd given her what I like to think of a fairly good education in the music of the 80s and into the early 90s. And so she loved to see these bands and go to these shows. So we went to see Nick Hayward. It was beyond bitter cold. That was possibly the coldest I can remember New York being, you know, where you stood outside and your mustache froze.
Yeah, right. Right.
That's how bitter it was. And it was empty. There was a terrible band from Canada called Moxie Fruvis as the opening act.
I remember that band. That's funny.
Kind of like a smarmy, smart alecky, worse version of the Violent Femmes.
Yeah.
But they were on first, and then it seemed like most of the audience left after they were done. Nick Hayward came out to maybe the record company people and a dozen diehards. So we were standing there, and he played like it was, you know, Madison Square Garden. He played his heart out. But I remembered reading something a couple of months previously when he'd started the tour for this album, and he picked up the guitar and he goes, I now want to do my favorite song by The Jam. And I just looked at Michelle, and Michelle already knew who The Jam were, and she was already educated, you know?
Yeah.
And I said, I just looked at her and said, Sounds from the Street. And sure enough, he blasted into a fantastic version of it. So, you know, it was obvious that he was doing it as a real tribute, because I loved the way that, you know, she just wants to listen to The Jam and just come out in that lyric.
Yeah.
You know? Of course, as a side note, I heard him play an A7, and I looked at her and I said, $10 says he's going to do Dr. Robert now. And she goes, you're on. And he goes, it's my favorite Beatles song off Revolver. I was like, I don't care that you're 15. Give me the cash.
That's right. And I'll leave you with one last story for this week. And it goes back to that Jimmy Buffett song that mentions Hank Snow. When I got my first real talk show job, because I worked in Tampa for a very long time as a producer and a host, so you're sort of a weekend and fill-in guy. But when I finally got the show that was mine, that was on WWTN-FM in Nashville, Tennessee, 99.7, and went there, and that studio is on the grounds of Opryland, and it's in the building that used to house the legendary WSM-AM 650. And so, you know, they have since moved into the Opryland Hotel, their studios are in there, but they used to be in this little white building. And when I first got the job, they sent me over, and this was at a time when the company that owned Opryland was still CBS. They sold it off fairly quickly after that to Gaylord Entertainment, but it was still CBS owned. So there were CBS logos everywhere, and everybody had assigned parking spaces and all of this shit. And I had to go over into the other side of the complex, past the hotel and into the sort of HR realm, which was backstage at CMT, Country Music Television. And I had to go back there and sign some paperwork and do some things like that. And the auditorium that is now the Grand Ole Opry is right on that same piece of property. And so I was told where to go and where to park, and more specifically where not to park, because there were several restricted spaces, and turned a corner and went into the parking lot. And the closest spot to the door had a sign on it. So I was like, well, I guess I'm not parking there. And as I pulled around, I saw that it said reserve parking for Hank Snow, and went, holy shit. It was great. It was one of those moments, you know, and I went, wow, it all came together right here. I'm 27 years old, and that this thing that happened when I was 8 and led me, you know, down one of my first musical paths is now sitting right in front of me. And I, you know, he wasn't parked there, but you better damn well believe I didn't park there either.
You know, that's the serendipitous part of life, my friend.
Yeah.
That's what makes it all so much interesting. It's those little moments.
Yep.
You know, that it's like I've often thought, you know, you just have an average day and nothing special to report, but you're going to remember that day like 25 years later because it was just, it's one of those moments.
Right. Yeah, too much fun. Well, that about does it for us this time around. We've got plenty more coming up on the next edition. And as you heard Rob Ross say, there's plenty of music that's on its way out between now and the end of the year. So it's way too much to talk about. And I will, next time around, have another update on our fight with the power company and with Sprint. By the way, I got to fight with them this week. Don't ever take their word for anything. Get it in writing before you do anything. That's all I will say. And that, by the way, is not just restricted to Sprint. That is any cell phone company. Don't ever take their word for anything. They are a bunch of lying bastards.
I hate all of them. That's why I've just stuck with AT&T once I went back to AT&T after ditching Sprint.
Yeah, I hear you, man. I don't blame you either.
It was singular when I first got it on my old what do you call it? What was the brand? The Trio.
Was it a Nokia cell phone?
No, it was a Trio. It was Palm.
Right.
Palm Trio.
Right.
I love that phone. I wish they still had that. That was my favorite of all my cell phones.
Yeah.
You know, I had that, and then I had the Palm Pre, which was just awful, and that sunk the company. And then I finally gave up the ghost and got an iPhone. So, but unlike every other stupid bastard on the planet, I'm only on my second iPhone. I had an iPhone 4 when I finally got one, and that lasted me up until the iPhone 6, and I'm still on a 6.
There you go. So, yeah. Here's my iPhone 6S. I'm holding it up to the camera. So, yeah, I'm right there with you. I'm only a half a generation ahead.
Yeah, well, fuck that. As long as it works, that's all I care about.
You got it, man. Have yourself a wonderful week, Rob Ross.
You too, my brother. Stay well, and thank you all for listening, and we will see you all again next week.